The readings from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 12, and starting at verse 12, and you can find it on page 1153 of the Church Bibles coming round now. So 1 Corinthians, chapter 12, verse 12. Just as a body, though one, has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with Christ. For we were all baptized by one Spirit, so as to form one body, whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free, and we were all given one Spirit to drink. And so the body is not made up of one part, but of many. Now, if the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. And if an ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? But in fact, God has placed the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable, and the parts of the body that we think are less honourable, we treat with special honour. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty. While our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has put the body together, giving greater honour to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honoured, every part rejoices with it. Now, you are the body of Christ, and each one of you is a part of it. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks very much, Nicholas. I said, sent my love to dads, but I think most of you were actually taking your children across the road at the time. So happy Father's Day to those who were across the road at the time. I want to remind you of a really wonderful time in life when you were at school. Some of you, that's a few more years ago than others. Not looking at anyone in particular. And to that wonderful, wonderful concept of the school orchestra. And if you are a parent living through those days at the moment, God bless you. The school orchestra. Did anyone here play the violin in the school orchestra? Fab. You're making me feel better because I played the clarinet, which was a bit squeaky, but really... Well done for going for it with the violin. I had a violin for a while, and I think it was my parents who gave up before I did. Anyway, I played the clarinet in the school orchestra, and somehow I got to the heady heights in about fourth form of secondary school to being first clarinet in the school orchestra. And it was my first rehearsal at the beginning of September term, playing clarinet in first clarinet mode. So there had been this other girl, like, so she'd gone off to, I don't know, Royal College or something to play her woodwind instruments, and she just left. So they were quite big shoes to fill in this school orchestra. And I'd been used to kind of play, you know, playing that sort of third below the melody, and kind of just, if she did it, then I'd do something a bit similar, but perhaps in a, like, harmony or something. Anyway, that safety blanket had gone. And so there I was first. And not only that, there was a second and a third clarinet as well. The responsibility was enormous, really big. Anyway, we sat down on this first rehearsal, and we got to that point, fourth form secondary school, where the music teacher, the leader of the music department, said, "We're going to sight read the whole thing, start to finish." I thought, that's bonkers, but we'll give it a go. Anyway, I had a few notes to play, and then I had this kind of like 16 bars of rest, which I thought, oh, I can play that. That's nice. Rest means you don't play anything. And so I was counting my 16 bars of rest. Then I noticed, as I was counting, kind of as I was in about bar four, that at the end of this 16 bars of rest, there was like two bars of real fiddly stuff. If anyone plays a woodwind instrument, this is like not the lowest, not the middle, but the top register. And that is squeak city, really, if you're kind of on the learning of the clarinet. So I thought, oh my goodness me, I haven't even tried that in private. Goodness, I'm never going to be able to do that, I know. I'll just sit out this time. Someone else will be able to play that. Anyway, this piece of music was called March to the Scaffold by Hector Berlioz. Already some people know the punchline to this joke. And Hector Berlioz, I've taken this personally ever since, decided that the instrument in the orchestra most sounding like the swish of the blade of the guillotine in the French Civil War was the clarinet. And it turned out that these fiddly few notes at the end of those bars, 16 bars rest, were the absolute climax of the whole piece, when the blade goes from top to bottom and then the head rolls into the basket. Sorry, it's a bit graphic. But I didn't know that at the time. So I sat there and I thought, I'll sit it out, let somebody else play it, and then I'll know how it goes and I'll do it. I'll go for it next time. So, of course, we get to that point. Nothing. Absolutely nothing happens. And I guess a few people have like listened to this on a CD. We didn't have MP3s in those days, so unless you were willing to pay 15 quid for some recording, or you went to ask, you were a teacher's pet and went to ask the music teacher, nobody had heard it, but I think a few people had. Anyway, there were a few faces who looked round at me, with me not even sitting there thinking, is it me now? I was sitting there with my clarinet like on the floor. Not even beginning to try. Music teacher, the conductor, stopped everything and went, "This is a clarinet solo. Why aren't you playing?" Now, by some miracle, I carried on to the end of term after that humiliating moment, and in orchestra, got it. And thankfully, it's a moment, a high moment in my childhood. I nailed it. But in that moment, I decided to let somebody else do the thing that I didn't realize at the time I was the only person who could do that particular job. It was really, really embarrassing. We often see this passage in 1 Corinthians, don't we, as an encouragement to play our part in the body of Christ. And that is absolutely one of its functions. And my story will go with me forever of the time I didn't even try to play the solo. The privilege of being first clarinet in the school orchestra passed me by, and I was ready for someone else to take the strain. Sometimes we either can't be bothered. Sometimes we're too busy. That's kind of normal, isn't it, for a lot of us? Sometimes we just don't think we can, and somebody else can do it better. But the truth is that God has put in each one of us skills and callings and talents and experience. We sometimes undervalue our own experience, and we think somebody else can do it better. And in doing that, we may well miss the moment that the task we were very particularly created for passes us by. And that's a huge shame and a real pain, honestly, for everybody else who's trying to do the best they can do to play their part, because actually we can sometimes really mess up the whole thing if we don't step up when God calls us to do so. But if we leave this passage there as a make sure you're playing your part in the body of Christ, in the church, in the community, I think we've missed something really important. Putting some Corinthian background around things perhaps might help us. I'm a big fan of a guy called Tony Thistleton. He's done a lot of work on the New Testament, and he's written like commentaries that look this thick, and he's written a shorter commentary on 1 Corinthians, which I think is truly fantastic. And it's the kind of book, maybe I'm just a bit sad, it's the kind, you think commentary, oh, like a dictionary or something, but actually it's one that you could read if you like doing that kind of thing. I don't know if anyone does. Anyway, I recommend it to you. And he describes the Corinthians as a thrusting, ambitious, and competitive people who were very interested in self-promotion and success. And he gives some background to their culture, some geography and some archaeology. He tells us that Corinth had access to a virtually inexhaustible water supply. It was a thriving trade center. If you look at a map, it's the bit where it's just the Corinth Canal sort of divides the Greek mainland. And it means that Europe and Asia Minor, as it was, were very accessible to each other because they didn't have to go round into the open water so much, and so lots of people stopped off there on the way in the ancient world and even today. So it was a real sort of major center of trade. And so the wealth and resources available to them led to a huge sense of confidence and self-sufficiency. I can see quite a lot of parallels with our culture here in Reigate. I'm not going to draw all of them. We can perhaps do that for ourselves. But actually a sense of achievement, a sense of confidence, a sense of if something goes wrong, I can probably put it right, a sense of we can grow and get better and better, some upward mobility, a place where people had choices, where there was a certain competitive edge to how well folks were doing. In the Corinthian culture, I'm not necessarily commenting on Reigate here, but you can own that for yourself. In the Corinthian culture, there was little concern for the plight of others in society. In fact, it was actually deeply unfashionable to help the poor or the needy or the disadvantaged because it showed a lack of absolute clear commitment and focus to being the best that you could be, to improving and increasing your own status. If you were double-minded in doing that and helping somebody else, really, you didn't care too much about it. That was deeply unfashionable. Instead, Corinthian society admired those who held the leading positions, who were healthy and robust, who reveled in luxurious and riotous living, Thistleton tells us. This surging tide of upward mobility meant that getting to the top of the hierarchical tree was of paramount importance, regardless of the effect it had on the poor and disadvantaged members of society. And the archaeology of the area shows us that in the houses of the elite, like the aristocracy and the richest and the healthiest and the wealthiest, there were actually separate dining areas according to your social status. And sometimes there were different grades of wine served to guests. Like people you'd ask to your house, you'd give them different quality of wine depending on their annual salary or where they lived in town or who they knew or their position at the gymnasium. And we laugh about that, but I wonder if there are parallels today. They were the norms of society. And I think this is where the second and perhaps the more important point comes in this passage. You see, the people of Corinth, the people who were doing it well. They were playing their part. They'd got the solo licked on the first go. They were really skilled at what they were doing, those people that everyone looked up to. In short, the Corinthians weren't in danger of missing their solo, but they were in danger of all being soloists. They were all being soloists in what was supposed to be an orchestra. The question for them wasn't whether they were playing their part, offering their gifts, stepping up to the mark. Everyone was trying to do that. The question for them was whether they were open to receiving the gifts offered by others. Gifts that perhaps weren't as good or as grand as their own gifts. Gifts that probably weren't as well skilled and honed or of as good quality as their own gifts. But were they able to accept those gifts with gratitude and humility, giving value to the contributions of those who were of lower status, but whose gifts were nonetheless sincerely offered? The answer in many cases was that the Corinthians were so interested in their own affairs, their own status, their own wealth, their own success and appearance in society, that they hadn't got time to look at what anyone else was doing or offering, even less if anyone needed their help or support. And so Paul turns to this image of the body. It's quite a famous image that we see in 1 Corinthians 12. And actually, this metaphor, it seems, was already quite a common metaphor in local politics. It was actually used, though, as a way of keeping the lower classes in their place. If you are a toenail or a nasal hair, make sure you know your place and stay there. Don't get lofty ideas of being a brain or an eye. But in his letter to the Corinthian church, Paul redeems the image, of course, by reminding the church that rather than suppressing the less glamorous parts of the body, they should be revered and highly valued. In that reading we had, verse 22 to 23, on the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honourable, we treat with special honour. Don't be so wrapped up in how you're doing that you become unable to revere the contribution of others. Don't be so wrapped up in how you're doing that you become unable to revere the contribution of others. I think this has played out recently in our own popular culture. I wonder if any of your households follow the annual entertainment feast that is Britain's Got Talent. Anyone watch that? No, it's just us. Oh, no, it's not just us. Lovely. It's actually a bit of a family favourite in our neck of the woods. And if you haven't seen it, every year for the last, I think it's 12 years now, a bewildering, I mean truly bewildering array of singers, dancers, magicians, acrobats, escape artists, impressionists, clowns, and some acts which really don't fall into any category at all, come on stage in the hope of winning quite a big prize and a spot on the bill at the Royal Variety performance. And I'm often staggered by it, not necessarily at the level of talent or skill shown, or sometimes indeed not shown, but how on earth some of these people discovered that they were good at what they ultimately are good at. I mean, there was from this year, there was two Korean brothers, and they discovered a gift of balancing. You think, okay, yeah, maybe they did gym classes when they were kids, but they discovered that they could. One of them could stand upright on the floor and like be juggling or something like that. And then his little brother would balance on top of him. And by that, I don't mean with his feet on his shoulders. They balanced on top of each other head to head. So one upright and then one upside down, straight up, head on head. No cushion or any luxury like that. I mean, how? How did they discover that that was a thing that they were going to be good at? I just don't know. I can only assume they had bunk beds when they were younger. I'm not sure. And then they do this thing, don't they, where they get like one of those showbiz loo roll inside type things, a bit more robust than that, and then a tea tray or something. So they've got like the seesaw going on the bottom, and then they're still balanced head to head on top of each other. I mean, how do you develop that? I've no idea. Anyway, they were really good at it. And I'm just really glad they didn't break their necks. But it was quite a thing to watch. I mean, that kind of thing gets onto Britain's Got Talent. But the most wonderful thing about this year's contest, spoiler alert, if it's still recorded on your whatever you've got at home, the most wonderful thing, I think, that two out of the three top acts, like the last ones left in the competition this year, were guys with really evident disabilities. And one guy, he was a guy with Asperger's. He was a comedian. It's a little bit lewd. I'm not necessarily recommending that, but we did watch it. And then a guy with cerebral palsy. And this guy called himself Lost Voice Guy. He'd never been able to talk, which was particularly beautiful when Deck put the mic to his mouth for an interview. And he just looked at him and kind of made this, you know, my whole act is predicated on the fact I can't talk. Deck looked rather embarrassed at that point. But he wrote his jokes using this voice generation software. You know, like Professor Stephen Hawking had a really clever computer that he could type in what he wanted to say quite quickly. And then it would be a voice, but quite a, you know, kind of a digitalized voice. And so his act was typing his jokes into this voice generating software, and just like his comedy timing was brilliant, and pressing different buttons to tell his jokes. He had some quite funny t-shirts as well, but really it was the iPad and the jokes. And this guy was so funny that he went on to win the whole show, and he's going to have a spot on the bill at the Royal Variety Performance later in the year. He could barely stand, he couldn't talk, and yet his contribution to this competition, which is all about survival of the fittest and being the best at what you do, was so highly valued that he received the highest vote from the British public. And at the end of the show, Dec went over to him, ignored the fact that he wasn't very glamorous. By the end of the show, he dribbled a bit onto his shirt. He was so excited that his arms and legs had gone a little bit into overdrive. I'm not sure he was fully sort of knowing where his arms and legs were going. And Dec gave him just the most wonderful, enormous embrace of congratulations. And he came away from the hug and he had a bit of spit on his top, and there was bits of the ticker tape kind of in his hair and up his nose, Dec and Lost Voice Guy, and it didn't matter at all. It didn't matter. Those parts of the body that seem weaker are indispensable. And I think, guys of Reigate and girls of Reigate, I think this is where the challenge is for us at the moment. If you are really capable, how do you feel when someone does something who is less capable than you? And you think, I could have done that better. And sometimes we don't, we step it, I've done it. I have absolutely done it. We step in and we go, oh, I'll do that. Because we know we can do it better. How about if we are a younger person and an older person is giving their contribution? The temptation, isn't it, to think, well, you know, you don't know all the songs of Ed Sheeran anymore. And, you're just a little bit out of date, out of touch. I'll do this because I'll do it in a more relevant way. We can dismiss, can't we, the contribution of an older person. And if we're an older person and we see a young person offering their contribution, well, it might be a bit scruffy and it might be a bit loud and that might upset us. And yet they are genuinely, sincerely offering whatever it is that God has made them good at into the body of Christ. And it might be our first reaction is to criticize the loud and the scruffy and miss the sincerely offered contribution. And of course, this passage has come to us in the context of a series about our welcome and our hospitality as a church. How do we welcome folks in? And someone comes in and they're new to the church. And you know what? We haven't worked out where they fit yet in our assessment of each other, because we're all doing it, aren't we? We're all assessing where we fit and where others fit in relation to us. You're all looking at me like, no, I never do that. You do. You really do. I do anyway. I do. And they say, oh, I can do this. And I think sometimes, I know again, I do this. I think, well, I need to wait and see. I need to wait and see where you fit and how you fit into my kind of categorizing and ordering of people so that I know whether or not you really can do this. It's sincerely offered. It's that person playing their part in the body of Christ. And sometimes we can be a bit nervous to accept it. If we're to be a welcoming and hospitable church to those we already know and to new friends we haven't made yet, we've absolutely got to be willing to listen to the music that others are making and not be so consumed with our own solo that we can't hear or receive the gifts of others. Those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. So for you this morning, I wonder which one of those applications of this famous passage is the right one. I wonder if you actually know, oh, I'm coming to church on a Sunday morning, but whether I'm a part of this community, whether I'm playing my part, And that doesn't mean you have to be on every rota going. Playing your part can look like just praying with this community and then going out there and being who God has called to you to be in your school, in your workplace, in your office, in your gym, in your sports club, in the hospital, in the shops. That's still playing your part in the body of Christ. It doesn't mean that you read the reading or that you wash the toilets every week, although I'm sure David would love help with that too. We have to do all the jobs together as a community. Maybe that's you. Maybe you're thinking, God, where are you asking me to kind of serve in your kingdom in this particular bit of the body of Christ? That is an important question. But I wonder if there's a bit of heart work for some of us to do, not necessarily just in church. It might be in our workplace, in another team that we're part of, where we keep getting annoyed by the person who isn't doing it right, who's trying really hard but not succeeding, and we think, I can do it better than you. And I wonder if we need a good dose of God's grace to say, I think actually I'm going to accept your gift. You might not look perfect. Your status might not be quite what I would like it to be. But please, I'm going to accept what you give in the body of Christ. I'm going to stand back. I'm going to tone down my solo so that I can hear yours.